Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 228 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host today. And today, my guest is Mike Morris. Now, Mike is a superstar attorney out of Detroit, Michigan, or thereabouts. Superstar in the sense, one of the biggest, one of the most profitable, one of the largest law firms in the state of Michigan, doing millions and millions and millions of dollars worth of business. So you might ask, gee, what does that have to do with us solo and small firm practitioners who just really want to try and get our head above water and grow our business a little bit? Well, Mike has written a book called Fireproof, the five-step model to take your law firm from unpredictable to wildly profitable. I was lucky enough to get a copy of this book a couple of weeks ago and read it and thought, wow, this is a system that this guy used to take his what most people would describe as a pretty successful law firm to start with, and take it to the stratospheric level. And yet the same principles can be applied and actually are more readily applied the smaller you are, and will lead to growth to that next level that you aspire to. So I wanted to chat with Mike and talk to him about that observation and see if he shared it. I think you'll find that that's exactly why he wrote the book, ironically enough. Now, I will warn you, there is some colorful language in this episode, so I would not recommend listening to it with the kids around, or if that's something that offends you, I apologize. But Mike's pretty passionate about what he's done and what he advocates. So there's a couple of words there that slip in. Nothing too crazy, but just want to give everybody fair warning. So without any further delay, let's listen to Mike Morris. Mike Morris, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Well, I'm really thrilled to have a heavy hitter like yourself on the program. It's not always the case where we get to talk to folks who have really developed into a superstar in the legal industry in every sense of the word. So I know your story, but let's bring our audience up to speed a little bit. Mike, tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
So I graduated law school in 1992. Worked for a small firm for a few years and learned really how to manage personal injury files. 1995, I went out and hung a shingle, and it was just me renting a little office, sharing space, sharing a receptionist, no staff, no secretary. And I went around town trying to find cases. I was guerrilla marketing everywhere. I asked everybody for cases. People started sending me cases. I started trying other law firms' cases. I wanted to, cut my teeth on their files. They paid for the costs because I didn't have any money to pay for the costs. And I started winning trials because if I didn't win, I didn't make any money off the case and I wasn't going to be able to put food on the table. Sure. So I found a way to win trials. I found a way to keep referral sources happy by settling the cases and trying cases and sending big referral fees. I hooked up with one of the biggest advertisers in Michigan, who I reference often in my book, not his real name, but we're going to call him Sid. And he would send me some cases, and then I did a good job. So he sent me more and more. I was getting 20, 30, 40 cases a week from him. doing a really good job, started growing my firm slowly, just kind of not knowing what I was doing, but adding people and adding space, kind of piecemeal, didn't know my numbers, wasn't advertising, just, you know, doing all this stuff. And then during this time, I had a fire in 2008 where my building burned down. And then in 2011, this person who'd been sending me cases for well over 10 years, I was sending him $4 million a year in referral fees. He came to my office in 2011, May, and said, "We are no longer sending you cases." And I mean, obviously, there's a lot to this deal, but
sure.
Long story short, for the intro purposes, I made a decision to go on TV to compete with him and the others on TV. This is June 2011. And, you know, 9 years later, we're, you know, one of the biggest advertisers here in Michigan doing, you know, 2011, we were settling about $17 million gross in cases. So that was not what the fees were. That was just the gross settlements.
Sure.
And I think last year we did 160 million. So the trajectory after running my business, figuring out how to run my business like a business, advertising, marketing, took me to the next stratosphere. And that's kind of where I am today.
Well, it's interesting. Let me go circle back a little bit and then we'll kind of dive in a little greater detail on some of this. So when you went to came out of law school, did you know you wanted to do personal injury law?
So my father was a personal injury attorney.
Okay.
For many years in Detroit. He was my idol. He was the person I came back to Detroit after going to school in Arizona just to go to law school near his office so I could be with him, be with his energy, have him teach me the law, because I respected him, the judges respected him, the lawyers respected him. And unfortunately, my first year law school exams, I'm sure you remember this, Neil, the worst exams in your whole 3 year.
Absolutely.
December exams were bad, and then the May exams came, and he died while I was in the middle of my exam period. I had already taken two, I had three to go, and he
died. In first semester?
Second semester. He died 49 years old.
Oh.
And I was back in Detroit already. And obviously it was, you know, in my book is called Fireproof. This was definitely one of the fires in my life and one of the major, major disasters. And you know, I decided, I thought, do I drop out of law school? Is this what I really want to do without my dad, who was going to be my partner, who was the reason I went to law school? And obviously I chose to move forward and took the next three exams and shockingly did okay on that and, you know, moved on. But so that's, yes, I always wanted to be a personal injury lawyer. I've never done anything else.
Well, I can relate to that first semester exam. As I mentioned in our pre-call, I went to law school late in life. So, you know, I'd done a lot of exams and been tested and tried in a lot of different ways, a lot of business experiences. And I remember that first exam was property law, a class that I thoroughly enjoyed and got a lot out of. And I remember taking that first exam and thinking, holy cow, I am way over my head. This is unbelievable. And I got through that first exam period, not with the tragedy that loomed like you did, but I remember my first semester was you know, September of 2011. So,
oh, wow.
So we went through that whole business of the attacks of 9/11.
Yep.
And that first exam, and I thought, I've blown it. This is the, and then I started thinking, well, this is really a dumb model where if you don't do well on your very first semester exams, you know, chances are you're not going to do well at the end of this experience, because you're not going to have that GPA. You're not going to be able to get that high-paying associate's position. And it's only later in life that I realized that that's not the be-all and end-all of going through law school. So anyway, enough of that. It was interesting that when you first started out as your solo practice in 95, that you had a caseload level that was pretty significant. You know, 20 to 30 cases a week is, you know, or even a month is something that a lot of people would aspire to. That must have been pretty overwhelming. You know, how did you keep all that straight? How did you sort all that out? Or is it just pure brute force at the time?
So my first 3 years out of law school, the firm that I worked for was a high volume, turn it, churn it type of auto, dog bite, slip and fall firm. I would work on 200 cases at any given time. I would try cases. I would talk to new clients. I would do all the depositions and writing. So it was really good training ground. When I started in September 1995, I didn't have a single case.
Right.
So the 20 or 30 cases didn't start for 5 or 6 years.
Okay.
I had to convince that lawyer that I was worthy to get on his list. This is a TV lawyer spending $5, $10 million a year. So it took some buildup. And as I was getting cases, you know, I spent 3-4 years with no secretary, no paralegal. And then, you know, you get to that point where you can't do it anymore. And I hired a part-time secretary, right? You know, an hourly. And then you move to a full-time secretary. And then you start thinking about an associate. I mean, it was one of those slow things, but I had no data. I couldn't tell you back then, you know, if you said to me, Michael, how many cases did you sign up this week? I would have had no idea. If you would have said to me, how much money do you have in the bank? I would have said, I have no idea. If you would have said, you know, anything about numbers or data or statistics, I would have had no idea. And so I was not making smart decisions. It worked because I was tenacious and I was fast and I was a good multitasker and I was smart and hungry and an entrepreneur, and I figured it out, but it was not easy. I could have done much better had I known then what I knew today. Had I read my book in law school, a lot of this would have been a lot smoother. I would have made a lot less mistakes. And so it was just trial and error. And I was a good marketer. I was a good, you know, I was able to get the message across to the people who had the cases, and I convinced them to give me a try.
You know, and I think that's a story that resonates with a lot of folks because, you just do what needs to be done at the moment. And, you know, fortunately for you, you obviously didn't need a lot of sleep at the time. And, you know, you're just trying to get from, you know, one step to the next and hoping you don't drop the ball along the way.
Neil, let me interrupt for one second. I truly believe that 90% of the solos, small firms are acting that way today in 2020. Yeah. I don't know your listeners, but I'm on your Facebook group. I'm connecting with these people. They're great people. It's a lot of solos, a lot of small firms. My sense in reading things is that that's what they're doing. They're great lawyers. They're hungry. They're running around, but they don't have a real structure in place because, like your podcast often talks about, and the subtitle of it is what they don't teach you in law school. They really do let us out of law school without any business sense whatsoever, and that's troubling. And I think that
very much so.
I think the message that you're trying to bring and I'm trying to bring and others are starting to bring is, you know, start earlier looking at your numbers, start earlier setting processes, start earlier putting a hiring and firing process together, et cetera. I mean, there's a million things to talk about, but if you start earlier, you're gonna have less pain and anguish and anxiety along the way.
Yeah, I think the dilemma that most people have or that I've experienced in interacting with them on this podcast is that most people take the approach that, look, I have to get some cases in the door. I have to get some cash flow going. I'll deal with defining my core values and coming up with a hiring plan and, you know, systematizing my practice when I have more action, when I have more activity going on. And what then happens is they find themselves, I've got 30 cases a week or a month, and it's just me. And I now I don't have time to do any of that. Now I'm frazzled. I wish I had done it, or they don't even think about it. They just try and live day to day, hour to hour, and get through these things. And I think your point is well made. Even if you are just devoting an hour a day to working on your business, you're going to be much better off in the long run.
100%. I couldn't agree more. And you know, when I started out, there was no such thing as the internet, right? Right. When I went to law school, we didn't have laptops, we didn't have iPads. But now the resources are at your fingertips. There are more people marketing to lawyers, it feels like, than ever before, trying to help them with their businesses. So there's really no excuse now not to, you know, learn and grow. And even if it's 20 minutes a day, at night, before you go to bed, to read a blog, listen to one of your podcasts, read a book, and you will be that much more ahead of where I was, and be able to achieve success sooner rather than later.
Well, let's just start with that point. I'm stunned, and maybe it's just me because I'm a lifelong learner. I was literally in school pretty much all of my life, going through four different careers. But I'm really stunned by how many attorneys I speak to who said, when I ask them, do you listen to podcasts, or do you read business books or books from people who are coaching in the legal space? And I can't tell you how many times I get the answer, you know what, I'm done at the office. I just need to decompress and put my feet up and play with the kids. You know, I really don't have time to do all these other things. You know, wish I did, but I don't. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, you'd have so much more time if you did that, you know, right. and then implemented them, those ideas and those practices and those routines in your own firm. You'd have right. even more time to do what you really want to do.
You know, one of the first titles, I don't even remember the exact wording of the first title of our book, Fireproof, but it was about, you know, work less, make more, right? And that's kind of what happened to me, was that when I did all of these things that we're talking about and that I lay out in the book, I worked less because I figured out how to delegate, and I made more money, and it allowed me to, it freed myself up to do more. To do exactly what I wanted to do, whether that be recreational, spend time with your family, work more, write a book, whatever. But you brought up an interesting point when you said a lot of lawyers don't want to engage in this process. And it made me think that I believe that there are two different types of lawyers. You know, I think the ones that are on your channel, listening to your stuff and reading the books, are entrepreneurial type lawyers. They want to grow. They want to learn. They're a learner like you and me. I read a book. I read every day. But then you have the majority of the lawyers, maybe it's 75, 80% of the lawyers, who just want to be a good lawyer. And they don't care. Like you said, they just want their next case. They're making decent money. They don't want to think about core values. They don't want to think about processes. They don't want to think about any of these things.
Yeah.
And they're going to stay, I don't know the right word. They're going to stay small, but they're going to stay in a 1, 2, 3 person shop, and they're going to make a nice living. They're going to be kind of harried all the time and pass out at the end of the night and not have real structure. And if you ask them, how many cases did you sign up last week? Or how much, you know, what's your average settlement? Or what's your average time to bring in money after you settle a case, or et cetera? They're not going to have an answer. They still don't know, and they'll never know. And that's the majority of the people. But the people listening to this podcast right now are not those people.
Right. And that may be fine for a lot of folks, but you can't behave that way and wish it were otherwise.
You know, correct.
Doesn't work that way. You can't.
No.
You can't have your nose to the legal grindstone and just try cases and be a good lawyer, and secretly wish that your business grew by leaps and bounds, and you could have the freedom to do what you want to do. You got to commit to that.
It takes work.
So we've alluded to this, we've mentioned it, we've talked around it. Let's get on with the idea. Let's talk about the book. The book's called Fireproof, the 5-step model to take your law firm from unpredictable to wildly profitable. What was your motivation for writing the book?
Well,
you don't have to write a book. You're successful enough that, you know, why write a book? So you must have been had the idea to do it for a particular reason.
So I, like you, am a lifetime learner. And I loved learning. And since that time, I read tons of business books. I engaged in, you know, the consulting process with a consultant and learned. And I like to learn something and apply it in my firm that day. And I thought after practicing for almost 30 years that I wanted to give back. One of the things that I do in my practice is we give back. And we give back, you know, charity-wise. I taught law school for several years at University of Detroit here, teaching law practice management, reaching, you know, 15, 20, 25 kids a semester. And I thought, how can I reach more? And I have all this knowledge that I love to share. So I sit down with my friends and other lawyers and, of course, give them free advice and pick their, you know, I ask them questions. And it's always the same. They don't have any answers. They don't know how to run a practice. And I thought, well, I'm pretty good at running a law practice. I have expertise in it now. Why not share my wisdom? And, you know, a good friend of mine suggested I write it. My COO, John Nockhazel, was my co-author, and he thought it was a great idea. So we did it. We did it for fun. We did it to share. We did it out of the love of teaching, and we learned a lot because when I went through the book, it's kind of like a cathartic experience looking back. Looking back over the time, it kind of put my life in perspective and all the things that happened to me and realizing Fireproof wasn't the original name of the book. Again, it was how to manage your practice better and work less and make more money. But it really is about these 5 things that we, you know, outlined in the book, this 5-step process that I think that if every young lawyer learned and did from their first day working as a lawyer, that they're going to have wild success and they're not going to be working 80, 90 hours a week and it's going to save them a lot of grief. So it was really just to give back. And that's kind of still what it is.
One of the things I really liked about the book and what resonated with me is that the principles that are described in it clearly worked in your case from taking what most people would say would be a pretty healthy firm to mega level practice. But as you articulated in the book and you said here today, it's those same exact principles, processes, and systems that if you use as a solo working from the kitchen table, that you're going to drive your own success in the same way.
Yes. So I'm sitting here with my book on my lap and, you know, running through the chapters, I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm a single practitioner. You know, chapter 1, know thyself, right? Are you good at everything? Are you the entrepreneur? Are you the worker bee? Are you the integrator, the visionary? Knowing who you are, knowing your strengths and weaknesses is huge. Second chapter, hiring, firing, and paying. Well, eventually, you're going to need to hire somebody, right? And this gives you lots of techniques how to find that best person, the best person for that position. Even if you're a solo hiring your first secretary, I outline the story of me hiring my first real secretary in chapter 2. Yeah. And it was one of the best stories, one of the greatest things that I've ever done that put me to where I'm at today, I believe. Chapter 3, the legal jumbotron, knowing your data, knowing your numbers, spending lots of pages on data and why it's important for lawyers to understand numbers, which is foreign to 98% of lawyers. Chapter 4, run your business like your biggest case, right? I mean, you know, don't just take your business for granted. Imagine your biggest case. Energy you spend on it. Spend that energy running your business. And then one of my favorite chapters, chapter 5, Cherry Garcia Beats Vanilla. And that helps, that'll help a solo practitioner, that'll help a person with 5 people in your law firm find your marketing message. And I spend a lot of time trying to help people figure out their message, and not to be boring, not to be vanilla, but to stand out like Jerry Garcia. And I've never met a lawyer that I couldn't find a differentiator. I've never met a lawyer that I couldn't pick out one or two things that say, this is your message. This is your gift. This is what makes you unique. But most lawyers see other lawyers, right? I did. When I first came out, I looked at all the successful lawyers and I said, oh, I want to be like them. I'm going to copy them.
Oh, yeah.
Because if it works for them, it's going to work for me. So like the herd mentality, right? It's not right. It's not accurate. You're not going to stand out. You're not going to break through our crazy competitive market. When I came out in 2011, there was seven lawyers spending $30+ million a year on my TV market. The Yellow Pages had 200. Remember the Yellow Pages?
Yeah, they had
200 full page ads. And if I wanted to get in, it wasn't alphabetical. I would have been at the end. So how was I going to get cases through regular marketing and regular advertising? It was near impossible. So you need to stand out. You need to figure it out. And that's what we talk about in the book. And it's not for it's not for TV advertisers. It's meant for the solos, the small firms to think. I give some real world exercises to come up with your message, who you are, how can you stand out? And the people who've read the book told me they thought it was successful. They've gotten lots of ideas how to position their firm a little bit differently. And that's very gratifying.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by our good friends at Ruby, and returning to the podcast, our friends at Spotlight Branding. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And for those of you who have listened for some time, you might recognize that returning to the sponsor position here with our podcast is Spotlight Branding. And Spotlight Branding, as you may remember, I was a client of theirs for many months, if not years, before they became a sponsor of the show. So I speak from experience that if you're looking to build content for your practice and have that managed for you in terms of blog posting, social media posting, email dissemination, email newsletter dissemination, that you can do no worse than Spotlight Branding. They're a terrific resource to draw upon, and I wholeheartedly support them, and I'm grateful for their sponsorship of this podcast. Yeah, you know, in terms of the herd mentality and doing what other successful attorneys have done, I made that very same mistake. And I told the story before. I had a friend of mine. I loved her website. I thought it was pretty cool. And I looked at the bottom to see who developed her website, and I gave him a call. And, hey, I want you to do a website, kind of like this one for me. And they said, okay, great. And that was one of the most expensive mistakes I've ever made. Mm-hmm. Because they gave me a cookie cutter website and it was ugly, but I was already committed to it. And it took me a long time to get out of that. And so just following what somebody else did blindly is, not a path to success. I don't want to give away all the secrets in the book, but I would like to kind of drill down a little bit on each of these chapters. You know, as you mentioned earlier, sure. You know, chapter one, Know Thyself. And one of the basic principles there is to be able to define and align with your core values. Now, I'm going to be honest with you, Mike. I almost stopped reading right there because I'm one of those guys that has a lot of difficulty trying to articulate what my core value is. I mean, isn't everybody's core value to be a good person, to do good work, to help the community and you know, be a respected individual? Isn't that what my core values are? So for somebody like me that has, you know, a challenge in working that through and developing that understanding, what would you advise someone to do in order to get that core value defined?
So I too don't like exercises in books like that. And it's funny that you mentioned that because I glaze over the exercises when I read business books. I don't take out that piece of paper and do the exercises.
Sure. Yeah.
And because that's my entrepreneurial brain. And it's like, I don't have time for this. And when my consultant said to me, we're going to set core values and it's going to take us all day, I said, I'm not wasting 8 hours setting core values. That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. That was me. And I fought it kicking and screaming.
And then you are alike in that regard.
and I get it. And anybody listening to this, if you're a true entrepreneur, you might feel the same way. But it's a mistake. And I learned the hard way. And so I spent 8 hours looking at what made me successful up until that point. And the three other people in the room with me, my executives or leadership team at the time, we were not even officially a leadership team, but we were, you know, these were my top people of I think we had 15 people at this point. And we sat around and said, what makes us successful? Why are we settling $17, $15 million worth of cases a year? Why is the Mike Morse brand doing well? And it wasn't, what do we hope to become in 5 years? It's right this second. What are we, you know, why are we so successful? It's not dreams. And that was a hard part. So you couldn't copy other people's core values because it wouldn't work. Because the core values are to set the tone for the future. Who are you going to hire? And if you're going to hire people, you want them to have the same values as you do. You don't want. So like my first one is hardworking, okay? We give 100% on everything we do. Our work ethic is, you know, better than anybody else. You know, we work late, stay weekends, etc. Do I want to hire somebody who really only wants to work part-time or 40 hours a week? No. Would that drive me crazy? Yes. Is that going to eliminate people in my search for my next lawyer? Absolutely. And so that was important to define. And if you look through the core values of the book, and we spend pages and pages on it, you don't put things in there like be truthful, be ethical, be nice. Because those are, you know, those are supposed to be DNA. Lawyers are supposed to be ethical. Those are given, right? We're lawyers. We have to be ethical. That would be a red flag if I saw that in a lawyer's website, because, you know, if you're not ethical, you know, you're nothing. So we came up to, you know, one of the other ones I love is dedicated to winning. Okay. And it was just something that we had to talk about because everything in our power we do to win. And I don't want a lawyer or paralegal or anybody working for me that they don't care if they win or lose. Like they're just kind of, you know, passe. I want somebody that if you lose, it feels like you want to throw up. It feels like you got punched in the stomach. You can't sleep that night. Okay. That's me. And that's why I work so hard to win. And I want people with the same mindset. And so, you know, that might sound strange, dedicated to winning to some people, but for me, it was like, because I worked so hard to win every case that that was part of my core value. And I asked people questions about that, you know, in an interview processes and when I'm talking to people, and they know me. And our web, you know, our firm, our phone number is 855 Mike Wins, and our website is the same. And, you know, winning is talked about all the time because that, as lawyers, that's what we're here for. But it's not win or lose, who cares?
At the end of the day, what form did these core values take? Was it a, you know, a tablet chiseled in stone that you hung up on the wall, or how did you kind of take that from a conceptual exercise and make it tangible and apply it to the practice?
So I stood up in front of my entire organization and I gave a long speech about them, and I explained to them. I explained in great detail what I meant about them. And yes, we made posters, and yes, they're all over our walls at the firm, but that was secondary because that's not going to do anything. Just to have a poster up there, people stop looking at the poster.
Yeah.
But, and I give a speech every quarter, by the way, in front of my entire staff. When I had 15 people and now I have 150 people, I stand up in front of every single person. I did a virtual one on Zoom 2 weeks ago. And every single meeting, I reiterate the core values and what they mean to me. And sometimes I have staff talk about them. And sometimes I say, what does this mean to you? And I just pick somebody out of the audience. And I say, Matt, tell me what dedicated to winning means to you. Sarah, what does loyalty to the firm mean to you? And these are, they live and breathe it. They have to memorize them. They know them. It's part of our culture. We talk about them. We reward people who embody them. We recognize people. We fire people who don't embody them. We hire people who have them. So it's part of the firm. It's used every single day.
And I'm assuming that your performance monitoring system is tied into your core value statement.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So let's move on to the hiring, firing, and staffing challenge. You know, again, for most solos, it's the question of when do I bring staff on? How do I do that is another issue. But when is usually the first question that is addressed. And I think what we've learned over the course of time is the sooner you can bring somebody on board, the better, because it gives you more time to do more things involved in growing your practice. You spent a lot of time in the book talking about testing and evaluating potential candidates. And this is a pet peeve of mine, going back to my, you know, past life experiences and my previous careers, is way too often interviewing potential hires involves the interviewer spending more time talking about the business than the interviewee talking about themselves. And you address that point specifically with testing and kind of follow up on that. So tell our audience a little bit about your philosophy in that regard.
So early on, first year, second year out of law school, my father-in-law, Steve Radom, introduced me to this concept of testing. And my wife and I at the time took a full day worth of battery of tests. I think there was 10 different tests. And then he gives you a report, just basically taking tests. And this report tells you who you are. From soup to nuts, everything about your personality, everything about how you learn, your weaknesses, your strengths, you know, everything, personality type. And these are like the MMPIs, and the Colby tests, and hopefully some of your listeners have heard of these.
And I
couldn't believe how accurate they were. I read a report that said, oh my God, this is me. I remember it. This is 25 plus years ago. It was life-changing. I thought, I can't believe that a test can do this. So he encouraged me when I was hiring my first real employee. Her name was Lori Sackett. She was my first real secretary, to test her. And it was a foreign concept, but after I took the test and read the report, I thought this was really smart. And it was the best thing I'd ever done. I mean, I got a detailed report back about Lori, told me her strengths and weaknesses. I knew how to manage her. I knew she was smart. I knew all of her strengths, and I hired her. And for the 11 or 12 years she was with me, the report was accurate. I used it often to manage her, and it was just a game changer. And it saved me. And subsequently, he's tested people who said, this person is going to be a problem because they don't live up to your core values. This, that, and the other thing are the red flags. Find out more information before you hire this person, basically. The tests never really tell you don't hire or hire, but they give you lots of good information to make your decisions. And yeah, the tests are expensive. So when I tested her, I think it was $1,000, $1,500 back in the day. And I thought that was a ton of money. But now, I don't even know how many tests we've given out, thousands, I'm sure. We test everybody, from the person who wants to work in my mailroom, to the person working my phones, to the person doing intake, to lawyers, to everybody in my firm gets tested. And we use that for to make good decisions, as well as training and mentoring and managing. So obviously I'm a huge believer in this stuff, but even to the lawyers who think that I'm full of shit and crazy, they should test themselves. Do the Colby. Take an MMPI. Do a Enneagram. Do a DISCUS test. There's a million tests out there. Do one. And I'm sure a lot of them are free online. Just to see if they're accurate for yourself. And then imagine doing your staff. Imagine your partners. Imagine your secretary and how you two can relate more. And there are consultants and coaches out there who will come into your firm and work with you and say, you know, when you're having issues with Mary Beth, this is how she likes to be told this, you know, feedback or constructive criticism. And Michael, this is how he likes to be heard or how he likes to be managed and this and that. And it makes it healthier. And I'm looking for a healthy work environment. And when there's stress cracks and you're not able to connect or manage or lead, this is a massive tool that will help any person listening. I don't care if you're a solo. Know who you are. Take a test. Learn about yourself. Don't be afraid. And if you offer it to somebody in your team to take the test with you and they say no, what does that tell you, Neil? Right. That tells you they're afraid to know who they are. They're afraid for you to know who they are. To me, that's a deal breaker. I won't hire anybody if they won't take these tests.
One of the things I think is interesting about it is that the whole interviewing and staffing process is geared towards putting the best people in the best position, you know, finding the best candidate for the opening that you have. And there are folks who spend an entire lifetime, an entire career, honing those skills as a job interviewer or a personal evaluator. As attorneys, we don't have time to invest in that area of expertise. So why wouldn't you take advantage of a test that could distill all of that down for you and give you the information that you were hoping to get, you know, through an interview process? And to me, it's again, a time-saving measure.
It's like cheating, Neil. It's like cheating.
It's like cheating. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. You're getting some inside scoop rather than the boring interview where they're going to put on their best clothes and their best attitude, and they're going to lie to you to get the job. We all been through that. I mean, like, whoever thinks that what I'm saying is full of shit, I mean, they're wrong. I mean, the interview process is majorly flawed. And that's why, and I outlined some of the questions in the book that I asked, depending on who the person is, but I throw people off. I throw lawyers off. I mean, I remember back in the day being, you know, when I was in court 20 hours, 30 hours a week, the judges would shoot questions at you and they'd ask you things you weren't prepared to answer. Well, how did you answer them? So I ask interview questions to people that they're not going to be prepared for. Like Neil, if you were an animal, what type of animal would you be and why? And if you could come up with a good answer that tells me about your personality and you rope it back into why that makes you a good team player, why that would make you good on my team, great. If you say, I'd be a dog. Why? Because I like dogs. Yeah. Shitty answer. Yeah. Right? I mean, but you get what I'm saying. I mean, I like to throw people off.
Right. The person who says my spirit animal is a three-toed sloth is probably not the one that you want to bring in.
Well, unless I say to them, well, why? Well, yeah. What is it about a sloth that, you know, why? And why does that resonate with who you are? And if they rope it into the law practice and who they are and whatnot. And I have lots of questions like that I lay out. And it makes the interview process more meaningful, in my opinion. Sure. Rather than asking people their strengths and weaknesses, what they're going to be prepared for, they're going to be prepared for those questions. I want to ask them questions they're not going to be prepared for. And these testing, you can't really cheat or lie through these tests. And that's why I'm just trying to, you know, it's just like calling references. Yeah, call this person. They're going to tell you about myself. Yeah, I bet they're going to give me an honest skinny about who you are.
Right. All right, well, let's move on to the next chapter, which was a legal jumbotron. And that's really knowing the numbers about your business. And I think we can all agree that's kind of an Achilles heel for most businesses, not just law firms. Most businesses, small businesses, are terrible in understanding the numbers that drive their enterprise. But I want to kind of focus in on one aspect of knowing your numbers, and that's how to get started. Because again, most of our listeners conceptually say, I understand, I need to know my numbers. How do I get started? What do I look for?
So I could spend the next hour talking about this, and we don't have time. In the book, we outline exactly the numbers that we believe are your first numbers, and we lay them all out. And, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of practice you have. You need to know the types of cases you're bringing in. You need to know the type of revenue. You need to know the amount of calls, the amount of signups, and you need to start tracking them. So one of the things that's coming out of this book that we did not anticipate, we don't mention it in the book, but lots of firms are calling us and asking our assistants to set up a legal jumbotron for them. My COO has already taken on, I think, 4 or 5 firms to help them do this. And what he's relaying to me is his shock that these firms don't have any data. And we thought that they would have some data and it would be messy. Some of these firms have no data. They don't keep track of anything. And so when I consult with them on the phone to see if they'd be a fit for us consulting and helping them, and they you know, firm will say, well, our intakes have been going down. And I say, okay, well, since when? Oh, I don't know. Maybe the last couple of years. Oh, really? And now's the first time you're looking at this. Well, how many intakes were you taking 2 years ago? Oh, I don't have that number ahead of me, in front of me. Well, how many today? I don't know. I think we signed up 3 or 4 last week. I mean, the conversations are the exact same for every firm that I talk to. And it's the owner who calls me, the entrepreneurial, you know, the person who's supposed to be running this, the visionary, doesn't know how many cases, doesn't know how much money they're bringing in, doesn't know what their best case in the office is, doesn't know their average fee at a case. I don't care if you're a criminal lawyer, defense, divorce lawyer, bankruptcy lawyer, personal injury lawyer, what's your average fee? That's a simple thing. You settled 50 cases last year, you made X dollars, do the math. These are simple calculations and people don't know them. But once they start tracking them, the light bulbs go off, right? And so what we say with the legal jumbotron and tying back to the fireproof theme is if you know your numbers, let's say you're signing up, 50, you're getting 50 calls a week. Okay, let's say it's consistent, 45 to 55 for a year or two. And then a week comes in, you got 36. And then 38, and then 34. 3 weeks in a row, you're in the 30s, okay? That's like a little small fire that you could put out with a cup of water and fix it, right? There's lots of things that you could think about, you could fix it. What's going on? But if you wait 2 years, and then you're down to 12 and 15 calls a week, it's a full-blown 3-alarm fire that you're just your building's burning down and it's too late.
I'm so pleased that you chose that data point to make your illustration with, because in my own experience, my own practice, when I started off as a solo, you know, it was just me, myself, and I, as I like to say, a three-man firm. And I answered the phones and did everything from soup to nuts. So in the beginning, my thought process was, well, I don't know that I need to actually record any data because I'm the one doing everything. I inherently understand and know what is going on, which isn't really true. But when I decided to start tracking my numbers, I said, well, let me start with something easy. And I started with number of calls because I realized I couldn't tell you how many calls I got in a week. I know I answered all of them, or some of them went to voicemail, which was another issue at the time. But I couldn't tell you how many calls I got in a week. And just starting with that number was kind of eye-opening because I said, wow, I thought I got a lot more calls than that.
That's interesting. Yeah. You know, whatever the data point, you know, I mean, it's probably not going to be one, but, you know, it's daunting for people. But listen, when I started collecting this thing, we had, you know, primitive software. I mean, now with things like WeDocket and Case Pacer and all these FileVine and all the things, you have so many options and they have reporting. And, you know, you got to be using some good software.
Right,
and if you can't figure it out, hire somebody who can, you know, or find somebody in your firm who can. You can't just, you know, have somebody answering calls, take a call, sorry, you don't have a case, and hang up. You should be gathering their cell phones. You should be gathering their email. You should be gathering their name and address in the system. And at the end of the week, review it. Okay, I got 23 calls this week. I signed up 4 cases. What's the percentage of that? Okay, next week, I signed up 22. I signed up this week. And then you start tracking them. And you look, and is it going up? Is it going down? If it's going down, what do I need to do to get it up? If it's going up, holy shit, I may need to hire some people because look at the trajectory of my firm. It's going up. I mean, that's how you make decisions. You can't make decisions with a gut feeling, which is how 90% of the lawyers out there are running around using their gut. And I'm a big gut believer. But when the data is there and available, you're just too lazy or you're just not using your brain to get it tracked. It's just not smart.
And the thing is also that you don't have to roll your own, key performance indicator program anymore. As you said, it's built into most of the major practice management software platforms. And the interesting thing I see many attorneys say, yeah, I know Clio, as an example, does a lot of reporting. But there's some parts of the system that I'm not using, so the reports aren't as useful or valid for me. And I would say, why don't you use that part of the system to make those reports extremely valuable to you? I don't really understand. All right, let's move on and press on here. Let's quickly talk about running your business like your biggest case. I think you addressed that point in the sense that, you know, all that you do to make your biggest case successful, your energy, the focus, the attention to detail, the planning, the strategy, those are all the things you need to bring to the table with respect to your business.
Absolutely. I mean, it was just an analogy for people to kind of get it, right? Because I think people aren't focusing on their business. I think they're focusing on that big case. They know they're going to make a big score on it. And then that's their whole focus. But I believe that their businesses are bigger than that one case. They're going to practice for 30 or 40 or 50 years. And they should start spending the same energy. I don't care what kind of, if you're a bankruptcy lawyer, divorce lawyer, criminal lawyer, personal injury lawyer, you have that big case in your office right now. What are you doing to win that case? Okay. And there's a plan. You have a plan for that big case. I don't care what it is. You have a plan. You're not just winging it. You have a plan. And that's the energy that I want you to bring to your law firm. Have a plan. Map it out. Write it out. Talk about it. Get everybody on board. the same way you plan for that big case. It's as simple as that. It's just realizing that your business is bigger than your best case.
I want to move not to diminish that chapter, because there's a lot of value in that, but I want to move to the last chapter here and spend a few minutes talking about Cherry Garcia Beats Vanilla. And I thought it was so interesting that a lot of books put this concept at the beginning. And I always think that's a little bit misplaced. I really like the fact that you have this at the end of your book, you know, trying to define what your discriminator, what your unique selling proposition is, and why you are special. And we talked briefly earlier on about how to identify what's special about your practice. Take us through that journey a little bit.
So Detroit is a very competitive, busy market. There's a lot of lawyers here fighting for the auto accident cases and the truck cases and the dog bite cases. $30, $40 million a year on TV. I mean, the Google searches are a fortune. Everybody's, you know, billboards. It's just hugely, hugely competitive. And I look at all those and I say, how am I going to compete? And so I just realized, and I just looked at them really hard and said, a lot of these guys are assholes. A lot of these guys are bullies. A lot of these guys are saying the same thing, and they're boring. And you hear the same thing from clients and from just reading and being smart. And I thought, well, you know, I don't think I'm any of those things. And I, you know, think I'm funny. I think I have a good sense of humor. I think I can make fun of myself. I'm self-deprecating. I like to give back to my community a lot, and on and on. And I list 8 or 10 or 12 differentiators in the book that I can't remember off the top of my head, but I focused on the opposite. Okay. These guys are bullies. All right. Some of my competitors are bullies. I'm not a bully. I was bullied in high school. I hate bullies. I think the insurance companies are bullies, and I'm going to come out after the bullies, and I'm going to be a bully fighter. Right? That's going to be just one of my differentiators, is that I'm one of the good guys standing up to the bullies. And when we do focus groups about what people think of me and my competitors, people say often that they think that I'm approachable, that I'm a nice guy, that I'm funny, that I'm a family man. I have my mom in some of my commercials and things like that. There's, you know, lots of things. And a lot of my commercials are funny, self-deprecating, are unique. And if any of your audience is curious to see any of these, they're on my YouTube channel, Mike Morse Law Firm. There's a tab with 50, 60 of my commercials. We won the best 30-second, the best 60-second commercial at the National Trial Lawyers Institute in Miami in January of 2020. Very proud of my commercials. And I get random emails every single day, people telling me how much they love my commercials, which I will bet you a lot of money, Neil, that my competitors don't get those same emails.
It's a difficult challenge that you have too, because I mean, let's face facts here, you know, the 800-pound gorilla in the room. Personal injury in and of itself is often looked at by the public as being a less than desirable practice area. Gives rise to the sleazy lawyer concept. Of course, until you need a personal injury lawyer, and then you really want to look for the best, right? And as you said, there's a lot of competition, and those folks that give rise to that negative image are who you're having to compete against. So by definition, you're automatically being lumped in with that misperception.
Good point. It's a very good point.
You have to fight against that. And to the extent that you're able to succeed, really, or have succeeded, is a real testimony to the strength of the commercials. And look, not everybody has the resources to do TV commercials these days. But you can go to your, and I have gone to your YouTube channel and watched the commercials. There's a lot you can learn just from watching the commercials. Okay.
Well, that's what I was going to say. You just said it. Because I don't want to talk. I think 99% of the people listening to this podcast are not going to ever go on TV, and they probably shouldn't go on TV. But like you just said, I think that there's a lot of things that they can see from these commercials that they can take into their own newsletter, their own videos that they create for their clients, for their social media channels.
Exactly.
Just to see, to dare to be a little different, opposite.
I'm going to tell you, I have already stolen from it. You know, your point about bringing some humor to the game, I literally lifted, and I put out a Facebook ad because I do estate planning, and there's a horrific picture of me in a Halloween costume, pretty scary, and I have that front and center in the ad. And that estate planning doesn't have to be scary, and it was meant to kind of grab the user's attention and something funny and self-deprecating, all those things that you said about yourself that are reflected in your commercials. I lifted and I used in my own ad. So
that's a great example.
I don't know a better way to agree with you than that.
Okay, I mean. Awesome. I love that story. And that's exactly what I want the readers of this book to take away, because the book wasn't written for TV lawyers. That's me. And I'm now a TV lawyer, and I share a lot about that, but it definitely translates to guys and gals who estate planning lawyers who don't have that kind of budget to, spend $5 million a year on TV.
Right.
But it works. It still works.
Let's plug the book one more time. It's called Fireproof, the 5-step model to take your law firm from unpredictable to wildly profitable. You can get it anywhere you buy books these days.
I just came out with an audio. It's going to be an audio version. A lot of my friends said, I don't like to read. I want to listen to it. I recorded the book. So the next week or two, it should be out. On Amazon and Audible and wherever you can buy those things.
Awesome. We'll look for it there. And Mike, tell our audience, if they want to follow up with you or sing your praises, what's the best way to reach out to you?
Well, my personal email is mike@855mikewins.com. Our website is 855mikewins.com. I'd love it if you left an Amazon review or a Google review, or just email me with questions. And we have lots of resources. If you want some consulting, if you want help with a legal jumbotron, we could point you in the right direction.
Perfect. Well, Mike, I want to thank you again. As I said, we don't always get the big superstars on this program, and it's great to have you on and find out that superstars start as regular attorneys in the very beginning. They're not just hatched into big time TV lawyers. So I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to be with us today on The Law Entrepreneur.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.